Hello and welcome to a brand new season of Something Rotten. It's 2024. We're in a whole new year of this and we're playing a game from 1998. It is Metal Gear Solid 1, the first in our two-part Metal Gear series. Who knows? We're doing Metal Gear Solid 1 and Metal Gear Solid 2 to start with. My name is Jacob Geller. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Blake Hester.
Jacob.
Hello, Blake.
I'm being radicalized by Hideo Kojima.
Yeah, in a good way?
I have a question, a concept I'd like to run by you. War. What is it good for? What do you think about that?
Stealth missions?
Well, we'll get into that.
Gamers.
We'll get into that. And that other voice that you just heard, we are very pleased to have as a guest on this first episode of our Metal Gear series, Super Bunny Hop, a.k.a. George Weidman from YouTube, who's done video essays forever, who's now doing an audiobook of the Iliad, and has done a lot of work on the Metal Gear series. George, thank you for coming on.
What's up, gamers? Also want to just point out the very radicalizing link that exists between getting into Metal Gear Solid and Homer and other ancient Greek epics. Oh, excuse me one moment. Yeah, if we want to talk about bisexual tension blooming on a magical battlefield, I can't believe how much parallels there are. The Iliad is totally a story where the soldiers in the middle of a battle take a break for a codec call that goes on for 20 minutes about the meaning of life. It's funny how one of those things led to another, but it makes total sense in retrospect.
Kojima, you know, a consumer of all great stories from every one of George Miller's movies to the Iliad to his own work that he references constantly.
Today is an interesting day, I think, to be embarking upon our Metal Gear journey. Because, Jacob, this is not a news show. It's not even particularly a topical show. But as I woke up this morning, 30 minutes before I had to record, it was announced Kojima and A24 are making a Death Stranding movie. Which I would say, the narrative of Death Stranding, not the most interesting part of that game. It was the mechanics, which, if you know how movies work, they're not interactive. But nevertheless, by God, he's making a movie.
I could see it. That's also absolutely hilarious because at the rate things are going, that one might actually come out faster than the actual Metal Gear Solid movie that was announced like 8 years ago.
Yeah, there's actually a studio attached to it, which is more than the MGS movie has had in the last decade of us talking about it. But
I love the Metal Gear Solid movie, the Bioshock movie, the Shadow of the Colossus movie. They all exist in a locked vault and no one will ever get to see them.
I'm not letting myself die until the Crazy Taxi movie comes out, Super Monkey Ball movie comes out. When we're done with this wave of like small children's toy movies that Barbie's beginning, you know, there's going to be a Play-Doh movie soon. The Monopoly movie will be a little more interesting. A Polly Pocket movie. Maybe then we will finally have Hollywood scrape such depths of the crusty rotten barrel that they will finally give us the much needed wave of gamer movies we've all been waiting for our entire 30-year long lives. Right?
I've maintained that best video game film adaptations are the ones that get weird with it, which is why Paul W.S. Anderson's Resident Evil series is the apex of the video games.
Yeah, films. I could see that. That's a respectable film scholar opinion I have heard shared by many genius academics.
Thank
as well.
You. And I do consider myself a genius academic, having dropped out of Jefferson Community and Technical College. But I think if Kojima does something weird, he's not just like, here's the game, but a movie. It could be cool. I'm into it. If it's just like, here's the game, but it's a movie, that's like, I already played the game, but it was mostly a movie. Because there's a lot of cutscenes in that fucking game.
And of course, it's an A24 movie.
Right.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. That makes a lot more sense than the production studio limbo that the Metal Gear Solid movie got caught in. It seems up his jam, you know, if we like slow shots of sometimes cringy dialogue that thinks it's a much bigger-brained, scholarly masterpiece than it really is, that seems like a good fit for him, yes.
Hey, speaking of a game written that seems it's smarter than it actually is. We should maybe talk about it.
We're talking about Metal Gear Solid, baby!
Can I read y'all a quote to start with?
Yeah.
Oh, I hope you have plenty of them. I hope you have a book over there.
I have the Kojima book, and it's so fucking bad. We'll probably come back to
the creative gene?
The creative gene, or, yeah.
I feel like I was lied to about the product. It turns out that it's like a collection of Rolling Stones articles that he already wrote with some commentary from him on
even,
his own writing.
They're not Rolling Stone articles with, like, interviews. He's just like, and this movie, I really liked it. I liked the way that it was a movie. No, okay, next essay.
Jacob, when I was at Rolling Stone, Kojima was one of our columnists. Do you remember this?
No.
Yeah.
Yes. Chris, yeah.
Brian Crescente, who took over Glixel after the, like, first round of it went down, he somehow finagled, I think it was Crescente, maybe it was the people before. Anyway, someone at Rolling Stone finagled giving Kojima a column that he would run monthly, and that was when I was doing, like, freelance news for him over there. And it was me and Kojima, we were coworkers.
You were right there with him? Yeah. Yeah, he was doing movie reviews and movie writings during the limbo between MGSV and Death Stranding. And one important thing to consider, all cultural considerations should get thrown into your brain for this one. He's not a native English speaker. Kojima's English has never been great. Kojima's written English has been infamously not great. There is a huge team of people who try to hold this stuff together who deserve a lot more credit. And when you're reading the Kojima book, you gotta keep the translation thing in mind, on top of some of the other more fair critical assessments that can be thrown his way.
We will certainly be talking about that more. Here's the quote. A film-like or cinematic game is a concept I've been talking about since the 2D Metal Gear days. Incorporating the essence of movies in the game with no incongruity is what Metal Gear Solid is all about.
Mm-hmm.
That's our launching point. No incongruity, everyone.
That doesn't sound as offensive to me as what I was preparing for.
Yeah, no.
You know, when someone reaches into a bag of Hideo Kojima quotes, there's at least a 30% chance they're just going to pull out a piece of bullshit.
Yeah.
And that one didn't seem quite as bullshit.
No, I did not read that to be like, here's how crazy this guy is. It is just, I think it's an interesting place to start. But I do want to talk about, so Blake and I have been upfront about the fact that this is the first time that we're playing these games. I, for one, have pretended that I have played Metal Gear Solid in casual conversations with people because I've just been like, yeah, I know what they're about.
Fuck
I know. Mm-hmm. I know. I'm ashamed
of
it.
And as I heard you guys telling me during the prep back and forth before we officially hit the record button, how far did we make it through this, guys?
We broke out of prison.
Yeah, that the halfway point.
So howlongtobeat.com, the official authoritative source on all things about how long video games take, is telling us that this is 11 and a half hours.
God damn it.
I swear, even as a kid, I remember going it faster. In the messages we were exchanging, I was telling you about how what a fast-paced, quick, knock-it-out-in-a-weekend adventure this game is. Come on, guys.
I disagree about it being fast-paced.
I was re-watching videos last night to prepare, and I couldn't believe how hard I was laughing at how much stuff the game throws at you so fast, so quickly, in that first act. And
I feel like we have a ton to talk about for this section, but also, this took me, we'll see if that how long to beat is accurate, because I don't know if the in-game clock is counting all of my deaths and restarts, but, like, boy, there are sections in this game that feel like they should be 45 seconds long that end up being, like, 30 minutes for me.
Was it boss fights?
Boss fights, just the general stealth. I think I'm just not good at stealth games, even though I've played the later Metal Gears, but this is, like, the controls and the kind of, like, the unforgivingness of some of the alert stuff has really tripped me up several times.
And Jacob, you are playing on easy, right?
I'm playing on easy.
Same.
I wish the audience could hear my eyes pop out just now.
George's eyes are doing the... he's like a cartoon character when he saw a sexy
you
animal.
You can hear the It totally exclamation pointed. I'm exclamation pointing over here.
I don't feel like this game is easy on easy. So I can't imagine what hard would be like, but like I'm struggling through it right now, especially the boss fights. Like we'll get into it. Sniper Wolf, maybe the worst boss fight in game history.
Oh, come on, man. What a bunch of malarkey. Worst in Metal Gear Solid, sure. But, like, you're talking about all of the rushed cinematic game based on movie garbage they were putting out up until fairly recently includes all those boss fights. And Sniper Wolf has the super cool story scenes that play before and after the actual dog shit boss fight. And you got, I know the controls are really bad. You have to aim with the D-pad for a point-and-click sniper battle. Yep. And you also have to put yourself in the line of fire. You can't really flank her. I know what you're talking about, but we can try to not be such animated overreacting gamers for a second, can't we? Worst in video game history.
It is the thing you need to understand about Blake is that Blake has a special ending for any video game he's playing that's not for this show, which is he gets to a point of frustration and just says, that's the Blake ending, and then stops playing.
Here's the thing, look. When you've had cancer twice in your life, you don't waste your time anymore. And I give games the Blake ending when I know it's a waste of my life to play them.
You say that, and then you started a podcast with me, the arguably the biggest waste of time.
Hey, you know, we're making people's lives demonstrably better out there on their commutes to work.
I just find that this grinds against a legacy that Metal Gear Solid 1 in particular, compared to its sequels, is known for pacing. It is known for pacing. It's regarded as pacing. People have played this game again and again for 10, 20, eventually it'll hit 30 years, and they'll constantly say, wow, it's aged so gracefully, it paces so well.
Well, and here's the thing, I agree with that. Like, I think that the section of this game that we played is truly a, you know, it is a roller coaster of, like, different set pieces and different cool things that you're doing in boss fights and whatever. That is all true. It's just that, like, it's like, I feel like I'm the actor that doesn't know my lines. You know, that, like, they're not asking me to do long, extended, difficult things. I just can't perform them because my coddled 2023 brain is not able to, like, get on board with the PS1 controls.
Also, it's a really simple game. It's, like, deconstructed into Pac-Man in the corner of your screen. The Soliton radar breaks it down into two dimensions of whether or not you walk into the danger zones, and that's all you gotta worry about, really.
But I do kind of know what you're talking about.
Welcome to Something Rotten, where George roasts us mercilessly. What I was going to ask is, Blake and I we're playing this game for the first time. What was your first encounter with Metal Gear, and like how old were you? Had you played the Metal Gear games before Metal Gear Solid? Were you just kind of thrown in, you know, to Solid 1? Did you start with 2? How did this happen?
I actually did start with 2. I rented it for a weekend for the brand spanking new PlayStation 2 when the game was still a overhyped gamer economy when Metal Gear Solid 2 was still an overhyped economic stimulus program in and of itself. I remember shooting the glass on the opening intro level and seeing how every individual cup in the cupboard of glasses you were shooting would react as a physics object and having my mind blown. I knew nothing what was going on in the story whatsoever at the time. I wouldn't have known anyway. I was like, what, 11 or 12? One of those awful years. I didn't know what was going on and didn't really fully get the appeal until playing the PC version of Metal Gear Solid, which is another thing that almost got forgotten to time, but was recently revived through some decent GOG re-releases, and then the latest Legacy Master Collection brought it back to PC again for the second time. There's technically 2 versions of it on PC now. Yeah, I first played Metal Gear Solid 2 on the PlayStation 2, and then I played Metal Gear Solid 1 on the PC, which is a really weird way that does not fit the mass market demographic. I did not have Psycho Mantis telling me to adjust the the video inputs on my television or read my memory card.
It'd be really fucked up if Psycho Mantis read your hard drive and just commented on the things that were on there.
What they do for the PC version instead is cut out the vocal dialogue when you're talking with Colonel Campbell and have just text say, by the way, if you're playing on a keyboard, you should now switch to a USB gamepad or vice versa. Instead of changing controller ports for Psycho Mantis for the PC version, you changed input ports on your computer. Didn't quite work as well. I played through that game on a keyboard, okay? Like, granted, I was like 12 years old, so I was just, you know, better at video games in general back then, like we all were. And, you know, all the games I loved back then were better back then, like everyone always thinks. But yeah, I played the PC version first. My formative memories of Metal Gear Solid don't actually include the fuzzy texture wobbles or the pixelated texture filtering that most people probably have too. Really weird way of going through it. It still hooked me regardless. Was a super duper fun teenage adventure that turned into a little like career Kickstarter 10-20 years later.
Blake, talk me through your experience of the beginning of this game. Well, actually, before you start the game, you texted me saying, I have no idea what's going on. And I said, there's a briefings section in the main menu that I watched. I watched all of before like starting the game, but it is like, it is so of this game that it's like, hey, do you really want to know what's going on? Well, there's a separate section that doesn't even, it's not included when you say start game, that is like borderline required for understanding like who all the characters are and why they are going to do the things that they're doing.
Yeah, I didn't know about that when I started the game.
It's like 45 minutes too.
It's a lot of talking.
I was thrown into the proverbial deep end of the Alaskan Sea, I suppose, in this submarine. My immediate impression was, wow, the water effects in this game are really good. The, like, warbling, I don't know what you would call that. The, like, the underwater shots of Snake where he's, like, all wavy looking. I was like, that's so impressive. And I think that's indicative of my overall thoughts about this game. Where, speaking frank, I'm not enjoying playing it. And I'm not necessarily enjoying the way the story is written. But as a product of its era, I think it is one of the most astounding pieces of video game I've ever played, as I constantly think, like, oh, this was released in 1998, and it is clearly, like, taking the medium very seriously and trying to be a serious entertainment, like, product in 98. I think that's incredible stuff. Playing it in 2023, I'm not having any fun. But I do think my immediate impression has become, like, a good centerpiece for what I feel 4.5 hours later. It's like, wow, how impressive. Not getting it, you know?
I had a similar thing without as much of the negativity. I think I'm probably a little between the two of y'all. Recently, actually, our someone who we cite frequently on the show, Thor High Heels, released a video talking about, like, the extra stuff in Metal Gear Solid games. But they just mentioned, like, when Snake comes out of that little, like, the like missile that he was shot out of the submarine in to infiltrate, there's like a pressure ripple that goes through the water, and there's so many things like that which just feels like, you know what, they didn't need to do that and they did, you know, like animations for Snake doing kind of unexpected things, like you see Snake climb down from an air vent and there is like an animation that shows like how he gets out of the air vent and stuff. And it's like, that is my consistently like the favorite part of the game for me, is just seeing these cinematic flourishes of just like animation and character building and kind of world setting that are so impressive.
No congruity.
It's true.
I super agree with you, Jacob. And there's something I keep thinking about in that Thor video, which I also recently watched, where they're like, you know, people are used to this game. I can't remember what it was, but it was like this shitty platformer that looked like garbage. And then you compare that to what MGS was doing at the time. And it's like, oh, clearly it's leagues ahead. And I think that's a little bit of revisionist history, because it's like a year before Final Fantasy VII came out and was its own, like, you know, technical showcase for how you do.
And contemporary to Metal Gear Solid, it was also directly competing with Ocarina of Time and Half-Life in terms of other games that were pushing the envelope forward just as much.
That said, I think the point is a valid one of just like, wow, this is clearly like setting the stage for where narrative AAA video games will go at a very early point. Like, it's so easy to just draw a straight line from this and like Final Fantasy VII to like what we're still playing.
Metal Gear Solid is one of the better examples of hitting the vein during a naive early time where they could take this concept more seriously. That video games for the next 20 years are going to be for teenage boys who want to have very complicated thoughts about whether or not they want to be a soldier.
Yeah, but very uncomplicated thoughts about whether they want to fuck any woman that talks to them at any time.
Hey,
because that...
Oh, I can't believe I'm getting hit on by the famous Solid Snake.
You know, seeing how visually impressive the game was, I was like, yeah, I kind of expected that. Snake being a sex pest was not what I expected from this game, but by God, this man could not come out in 2023. He'd be canceled day one.
Oh, it's fine.
I don't know.
I feel like what's kind of interesting is, like, having played other Kojima games, I'm aware of how his games treat women,
worse.
You know, in terms of, like, cinematography and costuming. What's actually interesting, and I feel almost works better in this, is having the main character be, like, an overt misogynist almost makes it feel like, oh, it's a character thing. Whereas in, like, Metal Gear Solid 5, when the camera is just, like, sweeping past every person's ass, then I'm like, well, this isn't from the character's point of view. This is just, like, the game is showing me.
Yeah, I don't... Metal Gear Solid 1 is, like, quaint in comparison to
right.
what's gonna happen later in the series, And a lot of that, like, does owe to the localization and dialogue rewriting from Jeremy Blaustein, I think the name was.
Oh, who worked on Silent Hill.
But there's definitely a balancing act going on between a very, very visible presence of female characters throughout the narrative from beginning to end versus the one who's actually a model there in the game world with you being a pincushion punching bag for the main character's motivations. Now, you guys did not play through the second half of the game, so you don't get to see whether or not there's some sort of redemption arc going on. I don't know what more I could possibly say about that to be lightweight on the spoilers, but I don't know. Wouldn't say outright misogynist. Snake is an anti-hero. He makes...
Right, okay, he learns.
He makes comments about Meryl's ass, right? And, but beyond him, the game writer, Kojima, is all more so the one who is responsible for treating Meryl as a pincushion. I can't really remember anything that would be objectionable by modern-day Twitter standards with regards to Mei Ling and Naomi. If anything, I remember Naomi, like, really being a little more groundbreaking in terms of, like, a woman in the game who's a competent, like, educated expert who is not sexualized. I don't remember neither of them but Mei Ling does get the, ooh, I'm getting hit on comment.
Yeah, the first thing that Snake says about Mei Ling is, like, a woman scientist.
A female sniper.
You know, so it's like, he's surprised, and we can say, you know, he's glad to see more diversity in the workplace if we want to give him credit.
I also just forgot that one of the villains is Sniper Wolf, and she's got, like, her cleavage out.
Yeah, Sniper Wolf.
But besides that, it's not, I don't think they do anything real opportunistically sexist with Sniper Wolf through the game either.
No, and she's nice to dogs, so she's a good
It's
person.
More what happens to Meryl. And even then, the stuff that does happen to Meryl, I think, is on such a smaller scale of perniciousness that you could get away with making a Metal Gear Solid remake nowadays without having to change much regarding her character. The Metal Gear Solid Delta 3 remake is coming out. And there's some extremely weird stuff that happens when you look into the behind-the-scenes medical background lore flavor text of that game's love interest, lady sidekick type character that I do visualize them probably not including for the remake. MGS1, on the other hand, I still rewatched it through a long play last night. I think it ages gracefully.
Yeah, you know, it's like, if I think there are Easter eggs where it's like, hey, if you do this enough times, Meryl won't have her pants on. And it's like, if you take that out and maybe make her the movement of her ass a little less highlighted in every camera scene, it's like, yeah, you know, I think quaint is the word for it, where it's like, wouldn't write a game like that if I was writing a game. But honestly, even in the oeuvre of Kojima's treatment of women, this is like a pretty light. Here's something that happened very early on in the game that I wrote with like 12 question marks, is Snake gets onto the base. He doesn't have anything, but he does have smokes. And Naomi says, how did you bring cigarettes in? And he says, I kept them in my stomach. What does that mean?
I was thinking about this literally last night, Jacob.
Okay, now you see, this is actually Hideo Kojima utilizing the narrative dissonance between the ludo-mechanical lenses of player perspectives to create a meta narrative in which whatever visual you have of those words is whatever he did to sneak them in.
There's another line like that actually, where you know, you find Meryl and Meryl has the key, and Snake says, how did you hide it? And Meryl says, women have more hiding places than men. And again, I was like, excuse me?
Oh yeah, that just means whatever you'd like it to mean, baby.
I think one of the playing this, the overwhelming experience that I had was similar to, and I think we've talked about this before on this show, like the experience of seeing some great work of art or literature and realizing that you had already seen the parody of it on The Simpsons. Like, there are so many things that I have realized I've seen across my, like, life of gaming that are explicit Metal Gear Solid 1 references in camera framing, in lines of dialogue, in, like, location and movements and whatever. And, like, It speaks to the pacing of this game that, like, the density of those moments is almost overwhelming. It's like every 10 minutes I feel like something quote-unquote iconic happens, and I realize, like, oh my gosh, I have seen that referenced like 40 different places.
Jacob, as a first-time player, do you feel like any of them are hitting you particularly hard?
I think the biggest things that are hitting me are, like, atmosphere. I think the music of this game fucking rocks, and it's, like, obviously, I've been hearing remixes of the music forever, and, you know, even in, like, Super Smash Bros., you know, you're hearing different things. I think the base, like, as a place is really neat and feels, it feels grounded. And something that I totally did not realize about this game is, like, it's not explicitly linear per se. Like, right. You're kind of running back and forth through the same location, opening up new doors and having new pathways. It's like, I'm not going to call it a Metroidvania because you're just finding new key cards, but like I am really surprised and kind of like pleased by how much work they're doing in making this place feel like a real place, even though as you can read if you read about the development of this game, apparently they sculpted all of the rooms out of Legos before modeling them, and you can tell that those rooms were made out of Legos when you look at the layout of them. But like, I really like how everything fits together.
There was one moment in this game that did genuinely kind of blow me away, and it was the Psycho Mantis fight when he told me to put my controller on the ground and he made it move with his brain. I was like, that's...
Yeah, you said, how did he do that?
I was like, that's literally the coolest shit of all time. So,
and you can only do it once. No other... Yeah. There's one other video game in all 30 years since Metal Gear Solid 1. I think the only game that really leaned into that fourth wall break stuff as hard as Metal Gear Solid 1 is Eternal Darkness.
But yeah.
Silicon Knights on the GameCube. Other than that, yeah, it's a trick that you can only get away with once. If any other game ever did that ever again, they'd say,
yep,
they'd get a whole bunch of immature gamers clogging up their their Steam reviews talking about what a cheap, lazy Metal Gear Solid 1 ripoff they were being.
You know what I liked is when I called Naomi on the codec and I said, my arm hurts. And Naomi said, put the controller against your arm.
Oh, yeah.
And then it vibrated.
How did you guys handle the Meryl phone number that's on the back of the CD case?
Okay, so we're both playing on the newly released MGS collection, which, for all the controversy around it, I think people are being babies. This thing's fucking cool.
Gamers being babies? You're kidding me.
Yeah.
This has never happened before in the history of humankind.
Yeah, I guess the games aren't at 4K or whatever people are mad about. Who cares? There's a lot of cool shit in there, including there's an online manual you can read because, you know, you don't have the video game manual. You go in the pause menu and select it. But before it launches you into it, it opens up like a high-res PNG of the front and back of it.
It feels like you're briefly playing Gone Home. It's like you pick up a cassette tape and you can, like, rotate it and read what's on the back.
It's really cool from the perspective of, one, you get to see the original front and back art of this thing really, like, high-res. You can zoom in really close. And also, that's how they get around some of the, like, you don't have the picture on the back of your jewel case. Like, you just spin it around and there it is. And I was like, that's a fun, clever little workaround. And I still got to, like, almost have the unique experience of figuring that out for the first time. You know, like, I knew what I was looking for. It was just a matter of finding it in the game. But it was cool. I liked the way they thought about that. The controller one for Psycho Mantis we can talk about. Less cool. Kind of dumb.
But I mean, it's like, yeah, so not only is that Meryl thing cool, and I had heard about that, and so I was like, okay, I think it's on the box. But another thing that surprised me, and this speaks to, like, how fast the pace of the game is, like, you can basically call anyone at any time, and they will talk about your situation, and your situation changes so fast that you can call people, like, every 5 minutes, and they'll have a different thing to say, which is
fully
really
voiced.
Cool. And, like, yeah, and it's like, you know, when I have gotten stuck in this game, I have largely just been able to call Campbell or something, and he will, you know, give a pretty overt hint on, like, what to do. And I just, like, I think I was expecting more repeating dialogue, that I would just call them and they would say the same thing that I had already heard. And, like, that really doesn't happen unless you're just standing in the same place and calling them repeatedly.
And it's actually something I need to get in my head more for the second half of this game, because I'm such a 2023 gamer that I'm just pulling up walkthroughs before thinking to call people on codec. And it's like, the game has it all in there. I don't need to read a walkthrough, but I gotta work past that and try to experience it.
There's also the really good sense of place and immersion that you were talking about, with how, like, catchy the music is and how grounded the area feels. I hate thinking of you having to break that very frequently for looking something up on a wiki, like you're playing Dark Souls instead, and it's weird.
Sure,
Dark Souls, a game famously without a sense of immersion or place.
You know how often the music just, like, gets to a rotten place. It does Silent Hill 1 stuff sometimes. Occasionally, yeah. The music will just be the sound of the wind howling through a metallic hallway. And that's it. That is the music track. It's beautiful sometimes.
I mean, there are, in this game, there are really excellent moments of, like, mechanical discovery in this game. Like, that I really enjoy. Like, fighting the android ninja, or Gray Fox.
Gray Fox! And
I don't think this is the best solution to the fight, but I was just like, oh, that's really cool. Is, like, having the realization that the chaff grenade will, like, stop him for a bit, and, like, coming to those conclusions. And it's something, like, again, I need to get past as a 2023 gamer, where I'm just looking up solutions at the, like, immediate moment of frustration. But, like, that moment stands out to me. It's like, oh, I can give myself some breathing room because he's an android and the chaff grenade will stun him.
So Hideo Kojima designed the game so that all your gadgets have more than one usage. The chaff grenade is useful for some boss fights. It also turns off cameras. It also turns off alert phases. If you can break line of sight with the guard, their radios won't keep the timer going as much as it otherwise would.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, all the gadgets that you get have some kind of multiple situational usages that occasionally come into handy as you play through the game again and again and again over multiple times, because it's 1998 and it's all you got. You know, one thing that I do think is a huge marketed difference between how a so-called cinematic game in the 2020s would be doing the same storyline compared to 1998 is... you don't have walking and talking through a simulated loading screen in Metal Gear Solid 1. It's all cutscenes. Sure. Very, very long cutscenes. A lot of gamers these days do not have tolerance for that sort of thing. I'm wondering if you guys have visions in your head of what this same storyline would look like if the characters were talking in a room while you as Solid Snake ran around in a circle waiting for the scripted event to end and keep going. But you wouldn't have your gameplay be broken. Maybe it would be more immersive, right, if it was a scripted sequence of NPCs talking.
Yeah, it's like Snake squeezing through a tight space between two rocks while talking, yeah, to the current.
Well, yeah. Otacon is being real serious about how shocked he is that war is bad. Yeah, I think there's a lot of an incongruity, if you will. Thank you, Kojima, for that thesaurus usage. With how the walking and talking style can make some very, very silly visuals happen when a story is trying to get serious with its tone.
Yeah, I've been playing the new God of War DLC that just dropped, and like, you know, the thing that we all love that AAA games do now, which is you're having a conversation with someone and then gameplay starts. And then they stop talking, and then they say, "As I was saying," and then, you know, pick up again in the middle of their thing. And it's like, I think that, you know, honestly, I think the cutscenes in this game are, like, they are long, but they are very engaging, you know? Yeah. Like, I am totally guilty of, like, sometimes playing a game and I just, without even thinking, pick up my phone when a cutscene starts, because it's like, I just don't care. And, like, in this, you know, even though sometimes I am kind of, I'm reading the codec calls instead of listening to them all, like, I'm not checked out. And I do think there is the kind of, like, the theater of limitations where, because you don't have characters doing actual facial expressions, you know, that all you have is kind of the head squishing up and down, like, there is a lot more thought put into how the scenes are framed and how the camera moves, because, like, they know that you can't just rely on doing, like, a shot reverse shot in the way that you know, a Witcher does,
yeah,
or a Horizon Zero Dawn.
And there's, like, really there's a lot of care put into a lot of the cutscenes and just, like, audio mixing, like the cutscene with President Baker, I think, in the prison where Meryl's next door. Like, they think about, like, muffling the conversation depending on which cell.
Yeah, when it pans over to Meryl. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's really smart. There's a lot of great shit in here. I just don't like playing it.
It's so elegant that you can miss it. But did you guys say you were doing Metal Gear Solid 2?
Yeah.
Because you'll notice it there. Holy shit, you'll notice it there. Yeah, the cutscene length is almost about on par with Metal Gear Solid 1, but the quality of the writing and the fun that the game developers are having from making the best of their limitations is not there. And it was, like, painfully obvious even back in 2002 that there's something about Metal Gear Solid 1's cutscenes that do make them inherently more watchable than what a lot of other games would be doing in its own series to a lot of the same time frames and time distributions.
I do love another thing that it's like, it's something that we kind of make fun of Kojima for, but I really like here, and I do think was probably very unique. I can't think of another game that would do this, is like when the characters are introduced, having the actor's name in parentheses under the character, I just think is so neat. Even though, as I recently learned, all of them except David Hayter's are pseudonyms, because there was, like, some question about, like, if they were allowed to do it with union rules. But I just, like, I do really like that Kojima's always been very focused on, like, here is the actor playing them. You know, that this is in my pursuit of making a filmic game,
yeah,
like, I am going to credit the actors that are doing this stuff, and I want you to think about them as actors and not just as animated polygons.
There is an explanation for a lot of what is unique about Metal Gear Solid 1 when you look into the history of late 90s union video game voice acting politics. There might have been so much voice work and such good performance work put into this game because they were able to get it done at a way cheaper rate than what would happen later on in a few years in video game history. And they also packed in so much of it from the technological incentive of showing off CDs in their storage space compared to Nintendo's babby cartridges for kiddie gamers in comparison.
I want to call out way back 7 years ago, I was watching this video. Our friend Ben Hansen, when he was still at Game Informer, and Tim Turry put together an oral history of the Metal Gear Solid voice acting, speaking to the casting and voice director and essentially every character, and talking about, you know, like getting all their memories from that time, how they were essentially all just in a house.
Yeah.
And they said that, like, they were literally in the same room as the people that were acting, so they just all had to be quiet. Like, when someone else, it wasn't like they had, like, a sound booth and then a separate thing, and they were also all kind of performing for each other because they were all, like, watching each other do these things. And so it really sounds, when they talk about it, it sounds like this very unique, kind of cheap, low-budget situation that still kind of imparted some magic onto the performances.
There's like a really rough audio compression method that they use in this game that gives it the vibe of a low-fidelity 90s game, but you have a very high-quality, timeless performance underneath it. And that is because there was traffic sounds coming from the windows. They put all the audio in the game, whether it's codec or cutscene, through heavy noise suppression filters, and you can hear it. There are other games from the 90s that actually have cleaner, crisper audio vocal tracks than Metal Gear Solid that everyone's forgotten about, that didn't have traffic in the windows, so they didn't have to run the sound files through so much processing.
Yeah, and I think it works. You know, I think it, like, for the tone, you know, for the codec calls especially, it's like, well, you assume they're kind of gonna sound like shit, and then it just feels, especially now, like you're kind of, you know, it's kind of like watching a VHS where it's like the defects add legitimacy to what you're watching.
George, this question is not applicable to you because I assume you can answer it very well, but Jacob, up to the point we have played, can you tell me the story of Metal Gear Solid 1, tactical espionage action?
I feel like
the on top story is actually not that complicated,
right?
And there are just like a lot of things that are kind of attempting to make it seem more complicated.
For sure.
So like the story that we're playing is that Snake is sent to an Alaskan military base, or he thinks it's a military base. Were you about to say something?
It's a civilian base.
It's a nuclear warhead disposal facility. Like you know,
that's
everyone
right.
has those down the street. Everyone knows what those are, right?
Yeah.
He is sent to that base because it has been taken over by terrorists who want the remains of Big Boss, and they're saying, right?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Okay.
You're right, okay. And it's really funny.
And they want the remains of Big Boss, and they are threatening a nuclear launch if they don't get those remains. So Snake is sent there to fetch, or he's sent there to, I don't know, stop them from doing a nuclear launch. On a secret mission, he's pulled out of retirement to do it, whatever.
Something I'd like to point out that I really liked from a gameplay perspective was instead of a in-depth tutorial about how Snake operates, he's sent with no equipment, like no guns or anything. And it's like, you got to find your own shit and then learn how to make it. I thought that was a beautiful touch at the beginning of this game.
That's how the military works, right? When they send guys onto missions. Yeah, I remember.
They say, put your cigarettes in your stomach. We're not sending you with anything
else. One of the quotes from Jeremy Blaustein is that he invented OSP out of thin air because he figured that coming up with any kind of acronyms for whatever stupid baloney happens in this game Will sound really official and convincing to the teenage audience if you just give it an acronym like on-site procedure, OSP. Got it. Roger that.
I'm 29. Sounded good to me. I was into it. I was like, that's cool. I'm going to figure out how to play this
game. You're going to procure your equipment on-site like a real super-duper special agent soldier.
So Snake gets onto the base. He finds out, people from his history here. There's Liquid Snake, who's a genetic clone of him, and other people. But largely, he's like, still, this is the mission. Campbell reveals that his niece is also, Meryl Silverberg, is also on the base, and he hopes that Snake can rescue her while he's there. Snake then finds out that, it's not simply that they are doing a nuclear launch, but actually this was a top secret development area for Metal Gear, a robot that is a big mech that is capable of launching nuclear weapons.
Jacob, please use the proper pronunciation. Metal Gear.
Metal Gear.
Metal Gear. And you find the scientist Otacon along the way, who developed Metal Gear but claims that he did not know that it was going to be used for... He thought it was just like a defense mech. He didn't know that it was going to be nuclear capable. But you find out that Campbell did know that it was... That both Metal Gear was here and it was, nuclear whatever. That's basically where we've left off.
Okay, hold on. The Otacon thing raises an interesting point. Otacon says, I really loved anime, so I wanted to become a scientist so I could build robots like I saw in anime. Fair.
Yes.
Why not? And then he's like, as far as I understand, the chief architect of Metal Gear, which is a weapon but also meant to dispose of nuclear bombs. But he didn't know it had the capability to shoot nuclear bombs. And this further...
Yeah, I was like, what fucking anime were you watching, Otacon?
Proves two things. One, in this world, scientists can be the dumbest human beings of all time. Two, you shouldn't give otakus jobs.
Otaku? What's jobs?
Huh. Here is some... Somehow I missed. I knew that Otacon liked anime. I knew he was, like, a fucking weeb. I did not know that Otacon is literally... Otaku convention. that is what his name is made out of.
I wrote
down, he's literally the wow cool robot guy. He's the guy who the Gundam shot is going over his head. He did say, I mean, I did think it was interesting that he was like, my grandpa was on the his grandpa helped develop the nuclear bomb. And then his dad also did something with nukes. And all three of our family members, we keep accidentally nuking places. And it's like, come on,
man. For the past, 5 minutes, I've just been laughing at stupid stuff that happens in Metal Gear Solid 1. You're reminding me that in the sequels of the game, in the prequels, you go meet his grandpa, and it's just as stupid in those games as it is in here, if not more so. I can't believe that, the synopsis that you've given is expanded upon in, multiple games with, something like 20 more hours of context left to discover for almost every single word of the synopsis over the course of the series history. They have milked it hilariously.
It is kind of like the almost, I guess it's the predecessor because we're doing this now, but it's like, the original Star Wars movie. You watch it and it's like, wow, look at these cool rebels. They help blow up a Death Star. And then over the past 20 years, we have learned who every single character in that movie is and their like huge backstory that has led them to this moment. But it's like, honestly, playing Metal Gear Solid 1, it's just kind of like, it's like, I know there's history from the Metal Gear games, but it doesn't, other than the only thing that feels like completely ridiculous and kind of a way that I don't understand what the game is doing is like Liquid Snake being the genetic clone. I'm kind of like, what the hell does that mean? Yeah. Where did that come from? Because everything else is like, it's completely overwritten and ridiculous, but like, it's all existing within just kind of the plot of this game, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I felt about Death Stranding, too. It's like, if you look at it from a mile away, it seems confusing, but within its own fiction, it's pretty straightforward, and I think Metal Gear Solid is as well. I also, an interesting thing, I don't know if you all knew this, I only learned this yesterday, Otacon's grandfather is portrayed in Oppenheimer by Benny Safdie. That's actually that, yeah, that's...
He's that guy?
Yeah, it's that guy.
That guy who's like, we should build a bigger bomb.
Yeah, that's actually Grandpa Otacon.
I just wish that with Death Stranding had characters named things like... I don't know. I do wish the names were as stupid and immediately laughable as Liquid Snake and Big Boss.
I'm sorry, but are you forgetting Die Hard?
I know. It was a statement that started to make the less sense the more and more it came out of my mouth. But something about these Metal Gear Solid 1 names gets me. It gets me so good. Like when you were talking about how Otacon is actually Otaku Convention, I just Otaku lost convention. It back here.
I mean, just when a character walks on screen and the little title card says Revolver Ocelot, I'm like, oh yeah, baby, I'm in.
I mean, there's some names in this game that are so hard. Like Shadow Moses, I don't know what the fuck it means.
Shadow Moses
care.
Is an awesome
it's
name.
It's so good. And then there's names like Otacon, where I'm like, why have we propped Kojima up for 20 years as the greatest writer in video games?
Because it's good. Metal Gear Solid 1 is good.
Here's the weirdest name in this game, and I do not have an explanation yet as of the where we are in the game at this recording. A Deep Throat? Like, who Snake's like, the guy from Watergate? And he's like, yeah.
Yeah, he gives you secret info about Shadow Moses. He's Deep Throat.
Yeah, why is he in this game? Why is the Watergate guy, why does he know about Shadow Moses?
He's not the same guy.
Teenage audience can feel like they're playing with something for grown-ups.
I do like when I go into my menu and there's the option to call Deep Throat, and I always call him and he never picks up.
Remarkable restraint on Kojima. To not have Snake comment on that name beyond saying, oh, like the Watergate guy.
Yeah, maybe the teenage audience thought it meant something else. I will admit that when I was growing up, I heard that name first from certain websites on the internet. And then Metal Gear Solid, I never knew about the 1970s movie until after Metal Gear Solid. Like, for a good 2-3 years of my childhood development, I associated the name Deep Throat with Watergate before any salacious movies from the 1970s that had lawsuits associated with them afterwards.
Jacob, you've seen that movie, correct? You love it?
Oh, yeah, you made a video essay
about
it. I've
not seen that movie.
Why not? It's a classic.
The semiotics of Deep Throat.
Behind the Green Door, you love them all. Big fan, Jacob Geller.
I think one of the thing in this game that I was most like, this is Kojima writing, other than the way that people talk to women, is and I should say I've only this is the first time I'm playing Metal Gear Solid. I have played Snatcher, and I really like Snatcher, which is, you know, an earlier Kojima project, and just the impulse to explain everything.
Yeah.
You know, that it is kind of an in the way where it's like, it seems like he read about a book about this and liked it and wanted to talk about it. But it's like early on there is a thing where you're in the vents and you see mice, and it's like, oh, follow those mice, they'll show you where you get out. Except it's not just that, because you actually have an extended call that talks about, like, these are Alaskan field mice. This is what they do. This is how they survive. And then the one that I wrote with, like, 5 exclamation points is when they were just explaining how a key card works. You know, they were just, like, lines and lines of, like, this is how a key card works.
You guys gotta understand, in 1998, key cards were still new and cool.
Is that how key cards work, though?
I don't think they use the salt in your body, but...
That they interact with your body's DNA? I don't think so.
But using a card as a key? Whoa, before you know it, we'll have flying cars and world peace.
Kojima remarkably reminds me of the Danish, I believe, director Lars von Trier. Not, I guess you could say in some ways the substance of their stories, but mainly the way they think their ideas are so incredible but don't trust their audience to get them that they have PowerPoint syndrome. And it popped up so quickly in this game. I was like, here's the PowerPoint section of this game where Kojima read a National Geographic article about mice, and now it's my problem. Lars von Trier does a similar thing in House the Jack Built, where he shows like literal PowerPoints to explain his movies.
There's also a lot of fun psychoanalysis to do with both authors when it comes to how they write women, particularly mother characters. Kojima has not gone through...
Yeah, well, should we talk about Death Stranding?
through any actual lawsuits.
And I do think one of the... this is a low bar, and also we might have to reflect on this part of the podcast in the future, but like one of the reasons that I think we do kind of let Kojima get away with more stuff is the fact that there are no allegations of him being a creep, that by all accounts he is just like a family man. And even though he like seems to be a kind of very horny creator, I don't think there's anything of like any of the women who've worked with him like saying that he was unpleasant to work with, but maybe I'm
seems
wrong.
Chill. I mean, I would say he is a creep. I've played several of his games, and I've seen the...
Yeah, but you know, he's like an artistic creep.
I'm just saying, we can't call him a creep when he has 30 years of games where he's a creep. Yeah.
Right.
Also, his fetishes are like totally on display throughout the series. He has a latex thing. He likes white women in latex.
And he likes when guys shit themselves. Is that another one?
He likes
one?
Men's asses and white women in latex.
He also has a really complex fetish about Lea Seydoux aging rapidly below the neck.
Loves that one. Let's talk about the actual gameplay of this for a while, because it's like, while the kind of the short version of it is like, I found it challenging. The more analytical I get, the more kind of interesting I think it is. You know, like, I think this is a game that it's like, I really respect almost everything that it's doing, and some of them are not, they're just not clicking with me in a way that I almost feel is my fault. But like, one of the things that I'm so impressed with that I think is like kind of an older game design thing, but also cool, is like consistently stumbling into items and being like, oh wait, that seems really important. It's cool that I just found it in a room and they didn't like tell me that I had to go there or like, you know, lock off the thing before. It's like finding the pistol, which is, it's not like there are a bunch of pistols in the game. It's like you find the SOCOM and it's just in a truck and it's not really remarked upon. I was like, oh my gosh, I found it. And I had the same thing with finding the suppressor and the FAMAS, I'm not sure how you're supposed to say it, but like, you know, these like pretty crucial items throughout the game that are just in a room. And even though I found them all, it feels very easy to miss them. It's cool, and it makes, you know, it makes exploring feel worthwhile.
Like stumbling upon like the diazepam, be like, weird.
Yeah, and then 4 hours later,
for the worst boss fight in video game history.
You're not following any waypoints on your HUD, and I mean, honestly, screen resolution and the claustrophobia of the levels is so tight you wouldn't need to anyway. They're very deliberately placed in ways that are not necessarily directly in front of a required pathway to get through the game, but so close that most players aren't going to miss it anyway. It's
claustrophobic is a really good word for this.
I like the way objectives in the game are delivered, where it's like, you need to go to the north building, basement 1. And then you don't have a waypoint, you don't have like a mission objective in the top left of your screen. It's just like, remember that, write it down. And it's the same with a lot of the codex, is like, just write down the fucking numbers.
You can tell it's north because the camera points.
Right, right, right. But like, right. I like the way a lot of that is like, deliver, what's the word, diegetically? Is that right?
It's intuitive.
Yeah.
It's teleological. Yeah.
I really enjoy that it's like, okay, now there's a point, it's kind of annoying, where you go to the sniper wolf fight, and then it's like, oh, you got to go find a sniper on the other side of Alaska, and you have to spend all the time running there. Cool. But
and it turns out it only takes you like five,
it's true,
10 minutes. It's like a wake up call, a Dark Souls style shortcut discovery. Yeah. Like, oh, I thought this game was way bigger than it is. It turns out it's really like 3 tables of Legos.
It's a little annoying to backtrack in the middle of a boss fight to the other side of the game, but I did like that. It was like, okay, they kind of told me where it was, and now I just have to go figure it out, rather than like Dead Space, where I just drop a line on the ground and follow that.
And there's new stuff on the way. They change enemy and camera placement from your before and after trips for that too. The game was infamous for backtracking for a few years after launch. That criticism has sort of fizzled away as time has gone on. I think the consensus now is that if you had to squeeze your game design budget in the 90s and make as much use as possible out of the tiny little Lego levels you had to work with, this is one of the examples of how to make the best of that kind of situation. If you guys play any of the classic Resident Evil games, you'll feel a much more harsher, spicier flavor in the back of your throat about how they handled backtracking in the 90s. Metal Gear Solid 1 does backtracking in the 90s, but it's like how Metal Gear Solid 1's women are treated better than the rest of the series. Yeah, sure, you gotta backtrack. It's just better in this game, okay?
It reminded me of, like, that picture of, like, this is what GTA 3 looks like if you take all the fog away, where you see that it's actually only, like, 3 blocks, but, like, because it's obscured. You know, like, something that I struggle with in this game, but I think gives it kind of this unique visual identity, is, like, the top-down camera is so close to you that you really, like, you... Basically, the guard's vision is almost bigger than the screen. And so, like, a guard can see you almost before you can see them on screen. And it makes up for that by kind of having a radar, which shows a bigger part of the map.
The Pac-Man menu.
Yeah, but, like... Because of that, it is, I think if you had just, like, if this was just, like, a third-person over-the-shoulder game, these rooms would feel minuscule. But because it's so tight on top of you and you can never see, like, everything at once, it gets away with, like, feeling like a military base, even though I bet the geometry of this thing is, like, it's, like, 5,000 square feet. Like, it's really... very small when you're thinking about, like, how big each room actually is.
It's when you look at the game map all in totality, it's also an A to B tunnel. It like looks and feels right. Bigger than it is. It looks and feels more non-linear than it is. I think that's a credit to the game design.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Here's something that was weird, and this is coming from me playing more modern stealth games. When you kill enemies, they just disappear. Yeah. Something that I really didn't expect is, like, the first time... I mean, I like how long you go without shooting a guy in this game. Or at least it was for me. That is, like, the first time that I shot anyone is when you're breaking Meryl out of prison and you have the whole conversation about, like, you need to pull the trigger. And then guards just kind of run and stand in front of you and you shoot them. But, like, I did not shoot a guy with a silenced pistol for, like, hours. And then when I did, and he fell on the ground and immediately disappeared, I was like, wait, isn't there a whole dragging bodies thing? But that doesn't happen until Metal Gear Solid 2.
Console memory limitation of the PlayStation 1. If you were playing Thief the Dark Project on the PC, you would have had your mind blown by having to hide bodies in 98.
Right.
But yeah, if you were playing games on console, you had to wait till 2002 to start worrying about that.
Blake, how do you feel about all the different items this game
Pretty
gives
cool.
you?
Into it.
I do think it's pretty cool.
As an immersive sim fan, I like being like, a Nikita, what can I do with that? And it turns out, play a really bad minigame with it. But there you go. No, I like getting an item and being like, what's the unique thing I gotta do with this? Like, smoking a fucking cigarette to reveal the lasers in a room?
That's so cool. God, I love that shit.
That's that Kojima genius right there. That's the one. I'm really into it.
I think comparing this to kind of modern immersive sims is interesting, because it's like when I'm playing Prey or Dishonored, I'll kind of go through the game and there will just be many things that I never use. And this is like a small enough game that actually when I find something, I'm like, I'm going to use this. You know, it's like I've used my night vision goggles and my like thermal goggles multiple times. I've used the mine detector. I've used like all of the kinds of grenades. Like I think it's, you know, again, it's like the scaled down version of this where it's like you can do a lot of things, but it's not like there are 20 ways out of every problem. Means that like I'm actually doing stuff. And even the little moments, like you can't have the cardboard box and the key card equipped at the same time. And so to get through this door, you have to take the box off and hold up the key card, and then you can get through and put the box back on.
Of course. I mean, the salt field surrounding your body is getting blocked by the cardboard box. It's perfectly logical to me.
Let's talk about the bosses.
No.
That's right. Big boss. The others.
okay. I'll get a laugh out of the name, but yeah, not the game's strongest point, is it?
Well, so here's my take on the bosses, is that I don't think any of them are conceptually boring. You know, like,
for sure.
Maybe Revolver is the only one where it's just kind of like shoot a guy. And even then, his kind of like, well, you can't go into the middle because they're C4 and he's like bouncing bullets at you. It's like they are all on paper. You could see why they would all be kind of interesting bosses. And I do like the speed that the game throws them at you. I mean, I really didn't think in the first half of this game we were going to fight like a lot of them.
Revolver. You got the Cyborg Ninja.
Yeah, Revolver, Cyborg Ninja.
You got the tank.
Psycho Mantis and Sniper Wolf.
Psycho Mantis. Okay. Exception to the statement. Psycho Mantis is a cool boss fight. Of all the other boss fights, Psycho Mantis sticks out like an absolute gem compared to the others.
And it's like, I did not mind Cyborg Ninja, and I did not mind the tank, even though, just because I kind of was able to do it relatively quickly. But like, I struggled less with the bosses than with the rest of the game. But Blake, how did you feel about
them? The only one I like really didn't like was Sniper Wolf. The Psycho Mantis fight, I mean, it's a fucking classic. Shouts out. I do think there's a little bit of a broken logic in the controller switch thing. It's like, who the fuck would have ever thought of that organically? Like, I needed the colonel to call me and be like, switch your controller port so he can't read your mind. It's like, I get what you're going for there, but that doesn't really make sense. The tank I thought was cool. Like, all of them, I mean, Revolver Ocelot notwithstanding, because there's not really a trick to him. But, like, once I figured out the trick to a lot of them, I thought it was really cool. Like, having to use the chaff grenade on the tank, I thought was really fun. And
What's the trick behind the Cyborg Ninja? Because every time I replay the game, I always have a trouble with that one. And I'm like the super duper fan here who's played it like 15 times.
Wants you to fist fight him. You have to unequip your weapons and fist fight him. And that's the trick.
And then when you do, it's like a really tough reflex challenge that gets harder the older you get because your reflexes get worse.
I thought that was cool. I was into it. I was like, why the fuck are my guns not hitting him? And then I like listened to his dialogue more. And I was like, this motherfucker wants to get the shit beat out of him.
Right. I mean, I think I for whatever reason, I mean, again, I'm playing on easy, so maybe a lot of my experiences don't quite count. But like the
you are valid, Jacob.
You know, I felt like with Cyborg Ninja, it was like, well, I just ran away from him when he was doing an attack and ran back in and punched him. And it's like, that worked for me.
Oh my god. I guess I should have been thinking of it as the Dark Souls of boss fights.
It's like, I'm
good at them to attack, roll behind, and then attack.
My favorite Metal Gear game is obviously Metal Gear Rising Revengeance, so I've already trained to fight Cyborg Ninjas.
That's right.
I think there's also a great missed opportunity with how all the boss fights use the same music track.
Mm-hmm.
That always struck me as a little weird, that you hear the same music in the middle of a super dramatic, special moment with your boss and you're fighting each other. It's the same music that you hear with the generic random soldiers when they go into an alert phase.
Yeah.
And man, like, if you could hear like some big deep bassy drums while fighting Vulcan Raven in the tank, or some elegant female harmonic vocals while you were fighting Sniper Wolf, that would have made them a lot more special. And it's not like those instruments aren't there on the composer's MIDI board that he made the soundtrack with. They just, that's the one thing they didn't have the budget for this game. They had more than enough budget for everything else they wanted to do, except like 6 unique music tracks for these boss fights.
The cutscene right before you fight Cyborg Ninja is hard on an astronomical level, where you see, because Cyborg Ninja is invisible, and you just see a impaled guy suspended in midair off his invisible sword. That shit rocks. That whole lead up was great.
Also, when he when he cuts off Revolver's hand, also very cool.
Yeah.
That was like one of the, you know, what some of the fun of this game is, like, I think I know most of the things that are going to happen, and then when something that I didn't expect happens, it feels like extra surprising because I thought I knew everything. Didn't know Revolver got his hand cut off. Didn't know Meryl got fucking shot. I know that she doesn't die because I've played Metal Gear Solid 4, but, like, you know, having her just get, like, sniped and be like, Snake, go live.
You played Metal Gear Solid 4 before Metal Gear Solid 1. You must have had no idea what was going on.
That was my first Metal Gear Solid game. Metal Gear Solid 4. A completely thematically coherent game.
Oh, that had to have been rough. Oh my goodness. I'm so sorry for you. I felt like I was getting thrown in the deep end with 2, but 4 is like getting tossed into open ocean compared to that. Wow.
That is somewhat correct.
At least now you know. Now you can play Metal Gear Solid 4 on a cleaner conscience.
Yeah.
That's right.
My first MGS game was the Zone of the Enders demo, but I've never played the rest of MGS 2.
Oh, yeah.
In fact,
that was totally a thing too, wasn't it?
In fact, I'll say, all I knew about MGS 2 for the longest time was the Zone of the Enders demo. I think I was a professional in the game industry when I found out you play that game as Raiden. Had no clue about that Switch.
That was a good freaking demo, too. It really made you believe the whole game was going to be like that, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and then I just never got the full game. I want to talk about this Sniper Wolf fight.
Yeah, here, actually, before you do, I just want to say something about the music, which is, I agree, I wish they had bespoke music tracks for the thing. However, I am so tickled whenever you are having like a semi-serious dialogue conversation and that Irish song, The Best Is Yet to Come, like when they start kind of piping that in to just like a dialogue scene, I love that shit. I love whenever, you know, kind of like, especially doing stuff with like vocal tracks, and it, like, what a weird choice for this game. I think one of the things that makes it stand out is like just how not fitting with like the genre it is to have this very kind of like somber Irish song. So anyway, love that shit.
And it's utilized very, very well too. Like the music chops are totally there for some badass boss music, and you see so many good examples of badass music all over the game. I think the whole soundtrack is great. With Metal Gear Solid 2, you also see that part of the game get decreased for the sake of cinematic authenticity, if that's not an oxymoron of all oxymorons. They used a like electronics Konami B-Mania composer named DJ Sammy for Metal Gear Solid 1. Metal Gear Solid 2 is Harry Gregson Williams, right, who is a famous orchestral composer for action movies, and so Metal Gear Solid 2 has an action movie soundtrack. Metal Gear Solid 1 has this really unique techno ambient video game soundscape that goes from Silent Hill 1 rotten industrial noise horror to some real catchy Metroid electronic beats that are almost danceable to this tear-jerking, emotionally ripping, soul-piercing Gaelic opera that the game begins and has its most emotionally heavy moments go into. It's good stuff. It's good stuff. Just wish there was boss music.
Sniper Wolf.
All right, so you go through the whole fucking process of tracking down the sniper, getting your diazepam. You're ready to go. You go all the way back through the wolf den. The wolves are so annoying, but then you see the puppy wolf, and it's so cute, and you're like, I can never stay mad at you, Kojima. But then, joke's on me, I can stay mad at Kojima, because I go into this boss fight, which is conceptually cool. Sniper at the end of a long hallway, and you have a sniper at the other end of it. Kind of like, I guess it's not too similar to the quiet introduction, but you can't play those fights similarly where you're just two snipers across the way from each other.
And at least, I don't know about two, but like every Metal Gear game has like a big sniper fight,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
Because it's 3 has the end, 4 has like sniper wolf, who's the wolf.
Yeah. Metal Gear Solid 2
There's like an infrared vision sniper shooting gallery. Yeah. Not a boss, but definitely 20 minutes of the game spent sniping in the 20-minute sniping section.
Oh, cool. Can't wait.
So anyway, you get to this conceptually cool fight, and then you realize you have to lay down in the middle of the most open area with no cover, no hope to take cover. You have to take diazepam, and then if you're smart, you'll instantly make sure your rations are equipped, because you're going to spend a lot of the fight being shot. And then when you're shot, a lot of times the camera down the scope will wildly spin 180 degrees, and you have to slowly try to move it back to center screen. But more often than not, you'll be shot two or three more times, which will completely fuck up your orientation again. So you have to spend all this fucking time just trying to aim it, by which point your rations are dwindling because you've been shot so much by a high-powered sniper, so it's just destroying your health. And then you finally get it. Maybe you get a good shot in on her. You're like, all right, now I got it. And then she runs, and you're like, all right, I'll just follow her. And you follow so closely, and then the camera decides it wants to speed up, and you completely overshoot. And then while you're trying to get it back, she'll shoot you again and kill you. And then you play this for 10 fucking times until I think the game maybe has dynamic difficulty, because when I beat it, it was like the easiest thing I'd ever done after 9 of the most obnoxious deaths I've ever had in a game. So
I don't know. I don't even know if there's a trick to this boss fight so much as it just is the trial and error learning curve of these really weird controls. There's a lot going on. Like,
yeah,
definitely a case where the two-dimensional legacy of 90s video game design and making the level out of Legos clashes with the point-and-click sniper battle they're putting you up with. I also think that this shows how, like, Kojima didn't really learn how military tactics actually work until he got an advisor on Metal Gear Solid 2. Because, like, you totally don't want, in any sort of game, simulation of combat. Really uncomfortable history there. But in this sort of situation, you don't go down the tunnel towards the sniper! That's they even say in the dialogue, like, oh, they usually have two to pin you down in a crossfire. You have no options for cover. All of the usual sniper movie tropes aren't there. The sniper game tropes are certainly not there. I don't think at that point in the game development process, like, Kojima had a lot of experience playing airsoft or paintball games, or he certainly didn't have the military advisor that was with him on MGS2 that would not have this kind of situation be depicted quite the way it is here. It's a weird, really weird, weird part of the game that doesn't make a lot of sense.
It just feels rushed, you know? It just feels like it was done really fast.
I would say it's not only weird, but it's bad. I also think it highlights an issue I have with the game, like just overarching playing it. We played, granted this is not the cleanest comparison, but we recently played Silent Hill 2 for the show, which came out a few years later, which at that point in the game industry, 3 years was basically like 400 years in technological improvement.
Oh, it really was. Man, it screws you up if you're a millennial when you get used to that as a kid.
There's an interesting thought experiment to do on the way the passage of time feels different because games no longer have like such technological improvements year over year. Anyway, Silent Hill 2 is a game that has not aged particularly well when you play it, but it's not a mechanically in-depth game, so that it's fine. It feels clunky, and it's not particularly fun, but like it's not a demanding game. So like you can get through it with little resistance. I think where Metal Gear Solid does not age gracefully is it is a somewhat mechanically demanding game, and it just like has aged like milk left in the summer sun. Because it's like just trying to kill two grunt enemies, like concept of aiming in this game is non-existent.
Yeah, the aiming is really, really tough. I'm sure you would, but like
you get used to it, but also it becomes like something that is a hard proposition to want to engage with, because this is such like an important game. Like I guess compared to Silent Hill 2, Silent Hill 2, an incredibly important game. Metal Gear Solid, on a different plane of importance existence. But it's, like, impossible to want to engage with this game because it is so demanding from you as a player. And for all the moments that's really cool, like the cigarette things or the Psycho Mantis things, there's the sniper fight or just two grunt enemies who have found me that make this game like so impossibly frustrating.
Blake, I do just want to say on the sniper wolf thing, I think there's I had a slightly more tactically sound approach than you, which is when you get shot, you just zoom out. You don't attempt to move your scope back. You just kind of like reorient yourself down the hallway.
I started doing that too, but also that's not the game solution, it feels like. That is you having to like bend around shitty design.
It's just, yeah, it's a, you know, it's a weak part. I do think there is a lot of this where I think it's like there are really interesting mechanics that are just held back by I think it is, like, I will say it's like my ability to interface with the clunky controls, you know, like I don't want to fully blame the game for this, because there is really just this aspect of like, I mean, one, we're in 2023, two, Blake and I play these games for podcasts, which means that like there is a level of kind of impatience and inability to like meet them on their own terms that you would definitely have if you were, this was one of the three games that you bought in 1998.
Yeah.
You know, like if I played this game for like 50 hours, I'm sure the aiming would be like second nature by the time I was done with it.
And if you were a teenager, gotta, you know, yep. Very important qualifier.
I feel like in my diatribe there, I did forget to point out, it's like I'm also coming to this game in 2023 when like standards are just so different for video games that it's like I don't necessarily hold it against the game because it is a product of its time. It just makes it so hard to play now for the first time. You know what I'm saying?
So if I may be the Metal Gear Solid defense force here for a minute or two, it is clunky, it is hard to learn. But you get used to it. You get used to it. One thing I've definitely noticed on replays is I don't even shoot bad guys. That's not even the optimal play strategy. The optimal play strategy is to sneak up behind them and snap their necks by repeatedly pressing the action button. The Soliton radar deconstructs the game down to a offshoot, an actual, the fans will not argue with this one, an offshoot of Pac-Man. Mm-hmm. It plays closer to a 2D modern indie budget game that would still, this day, be played from a top-down camera angle on a two-dimensional plane, because shooting and aiming in a 3D space is never required except for the stupid sniper battles, and the aiming is always more of a case where the game's mechanics are going to be working against you than for you in a way that almost distracts you from other tools that do the job just as well, if not as good. Grenades and C4s get utilized a lot more than guns in future playthroughs, and part of that is that you learn to anticipate the rhythm of guard movements around these very blocky Lego hallways, like Pac-Man and the Ghosts.
You
start getting into this routine of ambushing them around corners instead of taking them on head-on. If you do shoot them, you do it when you're well out of their range. You might use the first-person button to line it up ahead of time, but you'll be using the Soliton radar to play the game. Your eyes will be focused on this corner of the screen, which I do think is also kind of a bit of a demerit to it as well. But point is, yes, you're not necessarily wrong, but also you get used to it. It was thought out for the time space
that they were
putting it in. And if you watch playthroughs of people who are experienced with it, it's obviously going to look a lot more elegant and graceful than what you guys were going through on a deadline for a podcast in 2023 after having played Metal Gear Solid 4 first.
Well, I played that game like 15 years ago or whenever it came out, so I don't have any memory of it.
Not famous either way for having elegant controls throughout the whole rest of the series up until MGSV,
which is maybe the best controlling game ever made.
The fans call it MGSV, the casuals will call it MGS5. Yes, the controls for this whole series never get graceful until the fifth game in. I love the gameplay of 3 in particular, but boy oh boy is it a obligation to learn. If you learn these things, they do become elegant and graceful and will have a depiction of a sneaking mission that actually looks like it makes sense.
I also think it's funny when we're talking about how Metal Gear Solid has both anticipated and, like, you know, been the basis of a lot of modern design trends. you know, there was that period that I don't think happens as much now, but like in the mid 2010s, when every game had like a detective vision, and that's how you would play the entire game, whether it was like detective vision or like Witcher sense or whatever, where you'd have like your, you know, see-through mode. And it's like, that's just Soliton radar of like, I'm not looking at the game, I'm looking at like the representation of what the game is abstracted to its basic elements.
Yeah, yeah, that is... that is the result of the camera angle being behind your character's back, so you can't peek over cover, and the whatever thematic necessity the Soliton radar might not be around for games that take place in historical periods like that. One thing that I think is really cool about MGS3 is you can click a button on the controller that switches from top down to behind the back, so you got the best of both worlds, but it's cool. An extra button click. It takes a while to learn.
The torture scene.
Yeah.
It's cool. Oh,
the
where
prison
you're mashing?
Stuff.
It's cool.
You're mashing.
It's very cool. Then you go to prison. How do you use the ketchup? I couldn't figure it out.
It tells you in the item description. You press the action button. I did. While it's in the menu, and it makes it squirt.
No, it actually doesn't. It's like you have to. It doesn't tell you that you have to like lay down first and then use it. I struggled with this, and I was like reading it.
So my solution was when he went to take a shit, I got under the bed and hid, and then he was like, "Where'd he go?" And then I just got out and beat the shit out of him. But I wanted to use the ketchup and the handkerchief.
Both are valid options. There's like at least three ways out of there.
I also struggled using the ketchup, Blake, so you are not alone. I managed to do it, but by the time I figured out how to do it, he was looking at me. So he was just like, "What are you doing? Why are you squirting ketchup on yourself?"
I believe you can also call someone on the phone to get you out of there, if I'm remembering right.
You call Otacon, and then he comes. I tried calling other people, and it didn't necessarily work.
It's a trial and error thing.
Otacon just showed up for me. I didn't call anyone. I also think Grey Wolf can show up and bust you out.
Oh.
But yeah, I just hid under the bed, and then he unlocked the door for me.
Okay, point is, Metal Gear Solid Defense Force over here was gonna say that you're having a shared experience with the character where Solid Snake is hurting in the game, you're hurting in real life. That's part of the button mashing thing. It is supposed to make your thumb feel like shit.
Oh, no, I love that shit. I mean, I'm a defender of the microwave hallway. I love the torture.
Confused. You're supposed to... you're in prison. You're trying every option at your disposal.
Hey, at no point did I say I didn't like this section. I just said I want to know how to use the ketchup. That was my point. I thought this section was brilliant.
You dip your fry in it, Blake. You put it on your hamburger.
Shut up, Jacob.
See, I'm just way too oversensitive here for defending this stupid game about Liquid Snake fighting Solid Snake for the remains of Big Boss.
Every time I say Solid Snake, my partner just looks at me and she's like, "You know what you're saying." And I was like, "That's his name. I have to say
it." Uh-huh. You have to.
Okay, George, what did you want to talk about?
I wanted to talk about the beautiful juxtaposition going on between these incredibly stupid names of this incredibly stupid story that you cannot say out loud with your mouth without giggling your ass off in the background, and how this game hooked its claws so deep into so many people for such a long period of time because of a beautiful juxtaposition going on between that campy stupidity and a very... very prescient layer of real world issues, real politics, real conspiracies that get tackled throughout the story in a way that you don't see in most any games in general outside of like maybe Deus Ex 1. And you guys will not have this stuff spoiled for you. You have already encountered it. This game tries to tackle a few real world themes that were prescient, prevailing issues in the late 90s that have fizzled away, but one of them has not. And that is something rotten. It is called the military-industrial complex. It is about how super-duper the blackest of the black projects in the American military industry is held to unaccountable budget standards and completely decoupled from congressional and presidential oversight. This is a game about soldiers who are being lied to, who get pissed off and take over a military installation that is lying to the public. They send in another soldier to try and save the day, and they lie to him in the process. And it is all to protect the gazillion-dollar investment that they were doing at this facility to
Make a robot that can shoot nukes.
Make a robot that can shoot nukes, because the Cold War mad game is still going on in the ostensibly more optimistic geopolitical climate of 1998. Metal Gear Solid 1 might have looked kinda sorta weirdly behind the times at the time because of how much Cold War paranoia it engages with. Oopsie whoopsie, 3 years later, 9/11 happens and the military-industrial complex is lying to people all the time about the super-duper secret black projects. The stuff about genome editing and gene soldiers and that I don't think has aged nearly as well as the military-industrial complex, but the conversation that you have with the president of ArmsTech, the company is literally called ArmsTech, that conversation you had, still, you do not have to change a word for that and could make the game take place in the 2020s or 2030s. That's Kojima's prophetic streak coming through in Metal Gear Solid 1. In Metal Gear Solid 2, all the fans talk about what a genius prophet he must have been for predicting internet misinformation and internet censorship. Really, really, guys, if you read newspapers and read the books, you can be just as prophetic as Kojima. Point is, he was one of the only people in the video game industry doing it, and in many, many ways still kind of is, because I've just grown so frustrated sometimes with how underread game culture is in general, but Kojima includes real world issues in his games that get pulled off in really skillfully made ways compared to a lot of the other layers going on in his narratives. I think that is really cool and worth mentioning, and definitely something rotten that we should talk about for a few minutes here.
For sure. I mean, my favorite Snake line that I wrote down, other than he kept his smokes in his stomach, was, so patriotism is your excuse for circumventing the Constitution. It's like, hey man, the Patriot Act still hadn't happened yet, but like, that's a line.
Yeah, yeah. The omnipotency of terrorism as an easily identifiable but hard to define concept getting utilized as the excuse for circumventing the Constitution is absolutely something that was happening a lot in late 90s media that looks really prophetic and prescient nowadays. Kojima was absolutely on the pulse of that layer of his narrative as well. The terrorism spooks, the military-industrial complex spooks, the deprioritization of all other aspects of the human geopolitical historical experience for the sake of maintaining the sneakiest, fastest, coolest nukes,
yeah,
is something that has not gone away.
I mean, I think it's impressive to play the game 25 years afterwards and be like, damn, it still be kind of like that, huh? One of the parts I really liked and thought was interesting was there's a part where you go into a like hangar or whatever, and you can't use weapons because they're just like
leaking nuclear radioactivity materials.
And the game devotes several minutes of this to be like, not only is the world reckless with its use of nuclear weapons, it's reckless with its decommission of nuclear materials, which I thought was a very interesting concept, because like, I get all the weapon stuff. That's easy to get behind. But like, I like that this digs into just the entire industry around nukes and how bad it is for like the environment and how reckless people in charge are with something as like critical, ostensibly critical as like how you dispose of plutonium. Like, this game is like, hey, teenager in Wyoming, maybe think about it. I think that's really cool. I think that is the part of this game, the propheticism aside, I think that is the part of this game that has aged wonderfully, even when parts of it have not.
Yeah, it's, yes, kind of, it's like the field mice thing paying off. You know, it's like, do you need this information about Alaskan field mice? No. But if that amount of attention is paid to every detail in it, then you are going to get details about like how fucked our like military, industry, whatever is.
It also kind of sort of gives this faux authenticity vibe to the project. Like, oh, if Kojima knows all the trivia about field mice, surely he also knows all the trivia about decommissioning nuclear warheads.
Sure. Right. But I think, like, it's interesting because, of course, nukes in a lot of games are the ultimate weapon, because you don't get more powerful in a shooter than dropping a nuke. It's fucking cool in Call of Duty multiplayer when you nuke. I hate to say it, but like, it's cool to have a game be like, there, this is the worst shit. This should not be the end game of your kill count in a, like, in a shooter. Like, I really respect this game coming out and being like, I'm scared. of nukes.
And I think, you know, in a more specific way than simply we are anti-nuclear or anti-war. Like, I think one of the strengths of this game that we've seen so far is its stance is not just like simply war is bad and we shouldn't do it, but like these are the ways wars operate, you know, like these black sites with like unlisted budgets that are like, you know, supervised by the president and whatever, like that shit is more nitty-gritty than just I don't think we should do war, and like that's why it feels more substantial.
So have you guys been following the UFO news these days?
Ish.
I listened to Tom DeLong on Steve-O's podcast talk about it, and I feel like that was probably enough research, right?
Maybe. You might get the vibe I'm so excited about here, about how great it is to be a Metal Gear Solid fan reading stupid Metal Gear Solid stuff happening in the actual news right now, 25 years after the fact. So, okay, the latest dump of UFO lore is that UFOs were being crashed and recovered by the blackest of black projects in the U.S. military-industrial complex to reverse-engineer a nuclear weapon vehicle that can launch nukes using no propellant, bypassing radars and all the appropriate nuclear non-proliferation START treaties as well. The latest dialogue is that the government is working on flying saucer vehicles to do the same shit Metal Gear Solid Rex does in Metal Gear Solid 1. Launch a nuke that the radars can't detect.
That's bad, right?
It's crazy, crazy playing these games 25 years ago and reading stupid news stories of military disinformation campaigns that follow the exact same logic that the science fiction stories from childhood were tapping into, because yeah, the stuff about the military-industrial complex and the stories that we tell about it to make it feel okay has not gone away whatsoever.
It's you know, it is that kind of conspiracy theory thing where it's like there are two kinds of conspiracy theories, which are things that the U.S. government has just explicitly admitted that they did do, and blaming things on Jews. You know, and it's like, you just got to figure out which of those conspiracy theories you're talking about. Is there anything else that we just need to get out before we wrap up this first part? Here's something that I want to say. When Snake says his arm hurts, Naomi says that the nanomachines will give him a shot. Snake says, leave out the Benzedrine because it makes him too frisky. So Snake doesn't want to get horny off of his nanomachine shot.
It's a very serious situation. Now is not the time to get horny, Snake. He's not... He doesn't need the help. He does seem easily distracted in the middle of his super-duper secret important sneaking mission, much like the intended male teenage audience, I'm sure.
I like the Snake... sucks. I'm a fan of that. Like, when you first start playing as him, he's like, oh, he's so cool. And then by the time, like, you reach the Psycho Mantis fight, it's like, this dude is so fucking annoying.
He runs out of patience twice.
Right, like, not in a way where it's like, the game is poorly written, in a, like, smart way, as where Meryl's like, you're sad. Like, you suck. I really like the kind of twist on Snake as the protagonist of a video game.
And his response is it like a frustrated, impatient, are you fucking... If you knew the kind of shit I'd have to put up with, you'd be too... Ah.
Yeah. Like, I love that he just is the most annoying dude ever.
He turns into an anti-hero with President Baker, with Otacon, and with Meryl. His patience for normal civilians is really, really low, and he's pissed off and doesn't want to be there in the first place.
And that's why Kiefer Sutherland was the perfect pick to play him 20 years later.
The only thing we're missing is just blind drunk, which is Kiefer Sutherland's main cultural legacy.
We've all been there.
Kojima doesn't always make the right calls. If he was actually a prophet, he might have picked a different voice actor.
George, what was the thing that you needed to say before we wrapped up?
That David Hayter got turned on to Metal Gear Solid and the character of Solid Snake after reading through the script, and he thought the game was going to be more important than most other video games, if not pop art for male teenagers, because of that specific conversation with Armed Sex President Baker and how they get into the nuclear waste issues, how it brushes with real world issues that would not go away for decades afterwards.
Maybe David Hayter's the prophet. because he was right.
David Hayter also came up with the voice on the day of because he thought Snake was going to be younger, and then he read the script and realized that he was old, or at least retired. He's not old Snake yet, but you know, he's retired.
So he like settled on a grislier but more energetic Clint Eastwood interpretation, something like that. Oh my god, if you guys watch Kurt Russell movies, it ruins Metal Gear Solid. If you watch Escape from New York, if you watch The Rock, it ruins Metal Gear Solid. Great game though, love it. Timeless classic. Made for an immature audience by an immature guy who was ripping off movies, but great, love it, awesome, perfect video game, secret work of genius the whole time, what a prophet.
It's okay, Neil Druckmann would take that mantle 15 years later and run with it, you know, so there we go, it all worked out.
Oh yeah, everyone's catching up with Hideo Kojima already being kind of young at heart for his age.
Yeah, he turned 60 a few days ago.
What? And he looks good as hell.
I want to know what supplements he's taken and advertise them on my channel.
He should let himself go just like a little gray. I think it would look better. I think he should just let a little gray into his hair.
Do you think he's dyeing his hair, or do you think that's natural?
Yes. His hair is jet black. I think he's dyeing it. We will be finishing Metal Gear Solid next week. But George, you will not be there for that episode. Thank you so much for coming on, lending us your expertise, talking about this. You have a bunch of videos that are very old at this point about Metal Gear Solid, but you also just released a video on Pentiment that is cool and new and good, and you're doing an audiobook of the Iliad, which, as we talked about at the beginning, if you love homoerotic battlefield situations...
Homer-erotic.
That's why I watch The Simpsons.
Yeah, in the style of the author himself. I did a one-man audio drama where I was switching between all the voices, and it is shocking to find out how many archetypes begin here. Not that Kojima sure as hell didn't read the Iliad, but like inescapable pop culture archetypes that is like the or piece of fiction for the masculine combat power fantasy begins with the Iliad. I urge listeners to check it out. It is a very, very important media history lesson to be getting if you're into dumb military spy fiction video games for teenage boys.
All right, and that's it. Until next time, when we will be finishing Metal Gear Solid, my name is Jacob. Been joined by Blake and George. You've got the genes of a soldier, not a savior. Bye, everyone.